Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm absolutely delighted to be sitting across from John Hambrock, and it has been way too long. Kenosha's own John Hambrock, who is responsible for the marvelous comic strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, which is syndicated to newspapers across the country. And this was a long-time dream of John Hambrock. And of course, as probably the case with dreams which have long gestations and a couple of false starts and so on, when it finally comes true, it is the sweetest kind of success that someone could have. So here is John Hambrock now enjoying this wonderful life cartooning with The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. One of the reasons I felt prompted to invite John Hambrock back onto the program is because I noticed on Facebook that he was about to go to the National Cartoonist Society's annual Reuben Awards, and that would sort of be like the Oscars for cartoonists. And so I thought it would be a nice opportunity to reconnect with John Hambrock, find out how the comic strip is going, see what was going on at the Reubens this year, and also get a little sneak preview of the marvelous event, which is really coordinated by his wife, Anne, who also helps with the comic strip quite a lot. But the annual event every fall in September in Kenosha, which gathers a small group of special guest cartoonists from around the country representing various facets of the industry. And it's a rare opportunity for us here in this community to meet some of these people whose work we so admire and to meet the actual people who create these comic strips or editorial cartoons or greeting cards or whatever it might be, which happens to be their particular vehicle for their talents. So we have a lot to talk about. John Hambrock, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thanks a lot, Greg. You know, how long has it been anyway?
Since we've talked?
Since I've sat here and across from you and we've had a discussion. I bet it's been 5 years.
Maybe, and that makes I feel very badly about that. We've peripherally, of course, connected here at WGTD with these big fall events,
yeah,
in which most of the time you're at least lurking about, or at
my
least
my face Anne is against the window, peeking in like a child at a toy
right
store.
And that's always fun. We have maybe six cartoonists around this table.
Yeah.
It's a crowded studio, but so much fun. First of all, because it's been so long, I think we need to retread some basic ground, and even for people who heard our previous conversations, they might not remember the story of what I referred to in the introduction, that long gestation, this long-time dream you had of doing this. First of all, before Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, what were you busy doing? What paid the rent for John Hambrock?
I was working for an advertising and design agency in Chicago. I'd been there for a number of years. And it just sort of happened, you know. And my wife Anne often had expressed an interest in cartooning to me because she was always into cartooning. In fact, I tell this story when I give presentations to schools sometimes. I say, you know, when my wife and I, we knew each other in high school, but she would often invite boys over to the house and audition them. She would show them Charles Adams books. And if they would laugh at the cartoons, then she knew she had somebody that she could be interested in. If they looked at it and said, well, this isn't funny, what is this? Then, you know, show them the door, so long, take care, thanks for stopping by. Well, I laughed, you know, because I love Charles Adams. So that sort of got us on, if you want to say, of the very beginning of our journey on cartooning. That would probably be the moment. You know, all throughout our early marriage, she would collect cartoons, read cartoons, collect cartoon books. I was never really into it. When I was growing up, I didn't read. I read BC in the newspaper, maybe Beetle Bailey, Peanuts. That was about it. I had the books, the little book collections that Charles Schulz, that Sparky put out, but that was about it. And aside from that, I wasn't into superheroes. I didn't draw comics. I didn't really do any of that until...
And were you very artistic at all?
I was very artistic as a kid, and unfortunately none of my early art before the age of 12 exists. You know, somebody asked for some stuff recently, and I couldn't find anything before when I was 12. So I don't really know what that work was like. I was always drawing. In fact, we had a table at the house I grew up in, and my mother found out years later, underneath the table, I had done all these beautiful drawings that nobody knew existed until they moved the furniture out of the house and turned it over, and there's this whole collage of these wonderful drawings. I wish I had that table.
No kidding. Wow.
But so that kind of got us going on that in that direction. But it wasn't until probably 1992 that I really took a serious look at doing it as a profession. And I had no idea how hard it was to get into it. I had no idea what you even did. This was before the internet. So I had to go to the library and ask the librarian, how do I become a cartoonist? And you get the blank stares. Well, you might try this or you might try that. And so I had to do a lot of research to even know what to send, who to send it to, and what the process would be. And so I did that, and I sent off stuff to the major syndicates. A syndicate is it's not the mafia, of course. And there were many more of them back when I was trying to get started. Now there are three or four big syndicates. That's about it. I'm with King Features, who is the biggest syndicate. They carry all the comics like Popeye and Betty Boop and a lot of the newer stuff as well. But anyway, so I sent stuff off to the syndicates. And, of course, you always hear from writers and cartoonists about the long, the tall stack of rejection letters. Well, you know, I got my fair share of those. But I did get some interest from several of the syndicates early on, which really encouraged me to continue, you know, thinking, well, maybe I have a shot at this.
Hmm. Now, when you were first making this attempt and actually sitting down and, well, first of all, I suppose the first thing you had to do is just start creating some comic strips. I mean, before you even sent them off anyplace. I mean, what did it feel like to sit down and actually try to create? I don't even mean like a universe. I mean, a particular universe in which comic strip characters exist. I just mean four empty panels, which you had to fill with something funny and interesting. What did that feel like to sit down and actually do something which you'd only before that read? I mean, to try to create something like that yourself. Did that seem like a strange step out into a dark abyss?
It really did. And here's a good analogy for that. You go out, you stare up at the night sky, and you look in one direction and say, that's where I'm going to go. Okay. The choices are endless. When you sit down with a blank sheet of paper without any idea of where you're going to go with it, and that even happens with people that have set characters. They sit down, they see blank paper, and they just panic. But now imagine you don't have any characters. You have no idea. You're just going to start off into this unknown place in your mind and see what you can come up with. And it's a challenge. It's a real challenge.
So how long did that take, I mean, for you to start putting together some sample worthwhile comic strips? I mean, are we talking about days, weeks, months, years?
We're talking about 6 months. But, you know, the first comic I ever did, I worked on it with Anne. She and I both collaborated on this comic and came up with, it was called Second Nature. It was about, it was a group of animals, and it had a political bent to it. It dealt with a lot of social issues. And it's interesting because that was the comic, this would have been 1992, I believe, sent it off to the syndicates, and King Features was very, very interested. In fact, I got a call from the editor at King Features a couple weeks later, you know, telling me you wanted to talk about my comic. And I thought, wow, this is so easy. You just send stuff in and you're in the papers in 6 weeks. Wow, how simple and how naive. It took me 15 years after that to get going. It turns out, I found out later, that there was another comic very similar to mine that was being proposed and launched at the same time. It was a comic called Over the Hedge, if anybody's ever heard of that. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, T. Lewis and Michael Fry, they blew me out of the water as far as talent and content. And, you know, syndicates will not launch something that's similar to something that already exists. Mm-hmm. So you have to find that niche somewhere in there, and that's harder to do than you think.
Hmm. So that first effort was not successful, but it at least attracted a little bit of attention. Clearly, it demonstrated that you had some promise, some potential.
It put my name on, you know, they would now register my name when I would send something else. And especially with King. King Features has always been a big supporter of me and my work. So it wasn't a surprise that I eventually wound up there. Hmm. But yeah, it kind of got me, you know, it gets you excited a little bit. You have some interest. And once the bug bit, Greg, I got to tell you, there was no stopping.
Hmm. So once you realized, and they told you there's this other strip that's very similar, and that's what we're going.
No, they did not tell me that. Oh. No, I found out later after I was on the inside. I found out that was probably the reason that was the reason that it would have not been picked up. But there were a number of other things as well that kept me back. I mean, the strip was a little rough. You know, I hadn't been in the business very long, and it just goes to show you that someone like a complete outsider, a complete unknown, can eventually break in and make a place in this business. But name recognition does help. I'll give you an example. The comic Dustin, who is done by Jeff Parker, an editorial cartoonist, and Steve Kelly. These guys were well-known entities long before they did the comic Dustin. So naturally, when they made a presentation to the syndicates said, oh, you guys, we love you, of course. You're on board here. Yeah, so.
So did you say it took 15 years?
Almost 15 years.
Between these initial attempts and when finally you struck pay dirt with the brilliant mind of Evison Lee. In those years... how many different types of comic strips did you try to create? I mean, how many sort of concrete, tangible proposals did you end up creating?
Well, you know, I worked in fits and spurts. It's Second Nature ran for a couple years. We actually did a mailing. We had a subscription mailing thing where we would do a mailer every couple months.
So you continued to create that comic strip,
even though
it didn't sell to anybody, basically.
And continue to polish it. And it's interesting. Here's a really interesting story I'm just going to take off on for a second. The editor at King Features, Jay Kennedy, was his name, had contacted me and said, you know, I like it, but here's what I would do different. You know, I would do this or I would do that and I would do that. So I spent 6 months after our conversation doing exactly what he said to do and completely throwing my feelings out the window. I wanted to give him what he wanted. Well, it failed miserably, you know, because it wasn't my voice. It was his voice.
Mm.
So I did that for a couple years, you know, took a year or two off, did another comic called Bill. It was based on my relationship with my father and how the two of us would relate, sort of an odd couple, father and son kind of thing. And that didn't work out too well, you know, for obvious reasons. When you get family involved in something, it can often turn ugly. So that lasted about a year, and then I let that go. But then I brought on a comic with a little boy. There was a little boy in this comic Bill that I had created that I saw some potential. And so I started noodling around with this little boy character. Because my own son at the time was about 5 or 6. He was a very inventive, creative. He's an engineer now, by the way. Creative young man. And he would always come up with these grand ideas of stuff he wanted to build in the basement. And in fact, one time he asked me, he came to me, he was about 5 years old. He said, Dad, you know what? Can you dig a hole in the basement wall and build a ramp out to the backyard? I've got something I want to build. Okay. So there's Edison. Okay, but Edison was far off into the future even at that point. So I'm working with this little boy character, trying to come up with stuff, and I worked on some comics that were very, I call them gateway comics, you know, very simplistic. Kids would love them. They're very family friendly. and got a mediocre response from the syndicates, but I did get enough of a response that I thought I had something. Well, so I'm going along with Edison for a while, and then 2000 comes along, the year, you know, the election with the hanging chads and Bush and Gore and all that, and at that point, I was so fed up with politics. Whatever reason, I started throwing all that frustration into my comic strip with this little boy. I just sort of mixed everything in. I had politics and science and being a kid. I just stuck them all in a blender and cranked it up, and whatever came out came out. And wouldn't you know it, Greg, that was the truest voice I had ever allowed to emerge from me up until that point. And boy, it resonated, because I got so much positive feedback for that stuff. And that's what opened the door for King Features to eventually take me on. You know, these syndicates, you got to know, these syndicates launch one feature a year, maybe, if they even do that. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very, very difficult to break in.
It's like trying to get into Yale.
Okay. I've never tried that, but I trust you on that.
Right. I mean, a precious few spots, yeah. And a whole host of people desperate to secure one of those precious little spots. So to break through is an extraordinary accomplishment. So tell us about sort of the closing stretch where finally Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee was signed on. I mean, what does one have to do to sort of really put a package together in which somebody signs off on it? I mean, I remember this from a previous conversation, that maybe you have to create a certain number of comic strips to demonstrate that you really have a breadth of ability.
Well, once you're in, it doesn't mean you're in. You know, there are still a number of hurdles. And one of the biggest hurdles is getting the salespeople on board. You could go all the way. The editors could love it and say, you know, we want to go with this. But then it gets to the sales guys and they say, you know what, we can't sell this. So there are a number of people involved that have to sign off on it before they'll actually put you in print. It took a year and a half after they had contacted me until I saw it first appear in the newspapers, which was, I believe, November 6th of 2006. Yes. I believe. You know, I should know this figure.
No, I know it. Okay. I just saw it on your website.
Yeah,
I
think it was a long time ago.
Yeah, November of 2006, because I remember thinking, next November, we should have you on again.
Yes, it'll be the 10th anniversary, if
absolutely.
You can believe that.
Yeah.
So, but then you go through this development period, and I liken it to when you're getting onto the expressway, you have to sort of get up to speed. So when you're in traffic, you're not getting rear-ended by somebody who's going faster than you. So the development period sort of just gets you into the groove of having to create something 7 days a week, turn it on deadline, which I have long since dropped that end of it. I'm perpetually behind on all my deadlines, but and then you're set to go. And that first year or two is really critical, because about half the features that are launched fail within the first year. Some of them make it as far as 2 years. If you can make it over that hurdle, you're good, because a lot of papers, a lot of editors, they don't even like comics. Kenosha News had a great editor. Craig Swanson was just fantastic, and he's the one that signed me on. Editors will put a feature in, and if no one complains, then they're happy with it, you know, and they'll run with it for years and years and years. So once you build up a client base, you're pretty safe keeping most of those papers. We lost a couple in the last 9 years, but not a whole lot. We've had a lot of gains, not a lot of losses.
So but that's when a comic strip fails, is when too many newspapers drop you. I mean,
or for whatever reason, it doesn't get picked up. You know, for whatever reason, it just doesn't gain traction. And there's no, you know, if everybody knew the answer, then we'd have hits everywhere.
Right.
You know, the editors are, syndicates are always looking for the next Garfield or the next Peanuts, you know, or Bloom County. But those are rare. I would say our biggest hit right now is probably Stefan Pastis, who does Pearls Before Swine. Stefan is in so many papers. He's got a successful line of children's books. He's on tour all the time. He is the rock star of the comic world right now. We had Stephanie here a few years ago, you remember.
I remember vividly. Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Hembrock, who is responsible, along with his wife, Anne, for the wonderful comic strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, which a year from November will celebrate its 10th anniversary of existence. And we're talking with him about the creation of this comic strip and what that is like. We've mentioned your wife, Anne, a couple times. And, of course, as you mentioned, she has a lot to do with why you got so interested in this in the first place. And, of course, she's been a helpmate and guiding light and all kinds of things for you over the years. We should maybe say a word about the process by which this comic strip gets created, how you go from blank panels to finished strips, and the role that Anne plays in the actual creation of these comic strips, week after week, month after month, year after year.
Well, you know, she'll go through and she'll find ideas in magazines. She'll cut out stuff from newspapers and she'll say, "What do you think of this?" Or, "What do you think of that?" And she came up with an idea for a whole series. Gearing up, you had mentioned the Reuben Awards. Well, to take a week off to go to these awards means you have to get ahead on your comic. Hmm. And I got to tell you, Greg, you might as well tell me to – I have better chances of flying to the moon than getting six strips done in a week, you know, on top of the other six. It's just – it's almost an insurmountable task.
So it's like doing double.
It's doing double. So she came up with an idea for this series. It ran – a couple weeks ago, it was a really great series. Edison had created this sort of a magnifying glass.
Oh, yeah, Essence Glass.
The Essence Glass, yeah. Those were all Anne's. She came up with those, and I thought they were great.
To explain to our listeners, it's where Edison has this, it's like a giant magnifying glass, and when you look through it, you can see the true essence of whatever person that is. So, like, You looked at his grandpa sitting in a recliner, and he's a big giant Twinkie.
Yes.
Because he loves Twinkies, and what's his name, Senator Ottoman, looks at him sitting on a bar stool, and he looks like this big, I don't know, big ugly slug or something, and say, "Oh yeah, that's about right. I don't see much difference." And, yeah, that was a great series, and that was among other things a time saver for you.
It was, yeah, absolutely. It really was. I was able to meet the deadline on those. So generally, how it works is I'll sit down for the week and try to write up six or seven ideas. You know, Anne will join in when I ask her, and she'll sit down and write with me, you know. But I'll show her my scripts, and if she laughs, then I know I can continue. If she looks and scratches her head and says, "You know, honey, I don't get it," then I'm on to more writing. So, but then I do this cram session. I usually get all my writing done. My strips are due on Friday. I usually turn them in on Monday. It gives me the weekend to work on them. I'll get all my scripts written by, well, this week I'll get them all written by tomorrow. I'll work over the weekend doing all the inking. Anne does all the color for the comic, so that's her job. I'll throw them at her, you know, at 9 o'clock at night, go to bed and say, "Hun, you know, thanks, good night." She works on them tirelessly, does a really great job. She's colored for almost the whole time I've been doing this.
When you are in the process of creating these strips, are you you're starting with the words and then the drawings follow? Is that almost always the way it works?
That's how I work. You know, they're cartoonists, and doggone it, they do it so well. They just sit down and start doodling, and then they start from the left, and by the time they finish on the right, they have a comic. I don't know how they do that. I have to have the idea first, and I have to have the writing done first. So that's, you know, we all work different. There are a lot of them that work like I do.
Are you working on this, doing a concerted effort every day of the week?
Oh, on the comic? Yeah. Oh, I'm always looking. In fact, I'm writing in my head right now as we speak.
So you're going to add a handsome radio announcer to your
script. Or you get up in the middle of the night. It's just funny because you'll get one of those moments where it's 3 a.m. and you sit up, bolt upright in bed, and you go, "What a great idea." You write it down, you go back to sleep, you wake up in the morning and you look at it and you go, "Huh? What is that? That's not funny." You know. So the ideas come at all times. I used to write on the back of, I've had ideas written on gum wrappers before. You know how hard it is to write on foil?
It's,
or bank receipts, that kind of thing. wherever the moment strikes, you have to write it down. Now I have an iPhone, so I just type it into that. But
The universe in which this comic strip exists, well, there's a wonderful cast of characters. Let's start with this 10-year-old genius by the name of Edison Lee. You've already touched a little bit on where he came from. Tell us more about how you really formulated and finalized this character.
Well, yeah, you know, he was sort of based loosely on my oldest son. And now, you know, I have two other kids. My youngest son, there's some of him in there. Hmm. And actually, believe it or not, some of my daughter. All three of my kids have some role in the development of this character, some degree or another. But he just sort of grew. You know, he's me. He's mostly me. He's who I would have wanted to be when I was 10. Not as precocious, but inventive, able to, you know, take an idea from, you know, and implement it and see it through to its final outcome.
Well, and what I find so intriguing about him is he has this tireless appetite for trying to improve the world. I mean, forever trying to create these wacky, wild new inventions that are somehow going to change everything and for the better.
Well, it's interesting. A lot, you know, when people were first turned off by the name The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, and I'll share with you quickly that it was a name developed by committee. That was not the original name that I had for the comic, but it was Crumbs is what the name of the comic originally was. And they said, well, you can't go with that because people will think of Art Crumb. And of course, that's obviously true. But anyway, so he's brilliant, yes, but does he succeed all the time? Absolutely not. You know, his failures outnumber his successes, especially now that I brought on this girl, this female character named Katie Franklin, who gives him a run for his money and beats him hands down every time they're up against anything together. So he and money. He loves making money. Which is interesting because he's so concerned about the world and the environment, yet he's such a rabid capitalist at the same time. So the two can work together.
Right. I liked the comic strip not too long ago where he has a lemonade stand and he mentions that he's outsourced the production of his lemonade to China.
So
every glass is only a penny. But
you have to wait 6 weeks for it to arrive.
Right. He, of course, has two parents and a grandpa. And I just love the way those characters around him sort of elicit different facets of who he is and what their life together is.
Well, you know, the grandpa's a really key character. He and it's interesting, when I was in development, there was talk about dropping that character. And I fought the syndicate on that, and I won that battle. And, oh, I'm so glad that I did, because he's a key. And I would say that he's mostly me. He's who I would be if I were lazy, overweight, and like to eat snack cakes all the time. But he's my voice, primarily. And he's a key character. I've started developing more comics around those two, Edison and his grandpa. And it's interesting that sort of this relationship is developed between the two of them. And the parents, they're just sort of peripheral characters. They just offer that support and that grounding.
I appreciate how the grandpa, Orville, is forever perplexed by the modern world around him.
Oh, yeah.
You had a recent comic strip where he sits in front of the computer screen and then shrieks in horror because his PayPal account's been suspended. And Edison slips and says, "Grandpa, you never had a PayPal account." "Oh, no." And so he shrieks about that.
Because he doesn't have one.
Yeah, I just can't keep up with it all.
Every morning when I check my email, my PayPal account's been suspended. So I don't know. I finally saw that enough times that I thought, you know, this would be a good comic. And that's a good example of just living everyday life and going, you know, you could make something funny from this.
Absolutely. I want to get back to the technology thing in a second, but I know that another character that we see from time to time is Edison's cousin, Harley.
Yeah.
And he introduces an interesting element by being a very different kind of kid. I mean, some similarities to Edison, but there's some differences too.
Well, you know, Harley originally was Edison's brother.
Mm.
And that was a battle I lost in development, was that kid. They wanted him out. So I showed him the door. He went out. And a year later, I brought him back as a cousin.
Hmm.
So he did make it back. He's actually based on my youngest son, Christopher. Very similar in many ways to him. And he's sort of a reasonable voice, you know, to balance Edison's far-fetched, less than reality-based ideas.
Or a little less fanciful, a little more rooted in reality.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like that sober voice from this
sober voice is a good way of putting it. Yeah.
What you're describing in terms of the formation of the strip just ahead of it being launched, it sounds like quite an interesting process and maybe a frustrating one, maybe akin to what happens in Hollywood when someone has this wonderful idea for a sitcom, but before it actually makes it to the airwaves are all these people in the blue suits with clipboards and
exactly.
Weighing in. And so it sounds like comic strip artists face the same thing.
Well, you know, everybody wants to get their 2 cents in, and there was talk about Edison not having his glasses. They said, try him without his glasses. So I did it for 2 weeks, and it did not work. And poor Anne, she just shrieked. She couldn't stand it. He didn't have his glasses. And finally, I called my editor one day, and I said, you know, this just is not working. And he said, oh, okay, well, put him back. But it was somebody's idea. Well, you know, he looks too nerdy. Well, he's a nerdy character, okay, really. So for whatever reason, you know, everyone puts in their 2 cents, and then you try to delicately, you know, do this, walk through this minefield of ideas, and you don't want to make anybody angry or upset, because you're going through the process, and your biggest fear is, I don't want to blow this.
Yeah.
You know, I've come this far. I've gotten in the door. I don't want to blow this over something as silly as glasses. But looking back, it's like, well, that was the essence of the whole character. Mm.
I guess that's part of the challenge, isn't it, is figuring out what is essential to this. What is the heart and soul of this comic strip that I cannot surrender, you know, to the whims of someone else?
Oh, the early Edisons were, he was drawn horribly for a while. And that was one of the things they said early on. They said, you have to change his look. And I'm so glad they did, Greg, because it opened up the door for me. I was relieved, actually. Oh, good. They're giving me a second chance to reboot here and recreate this character. So he did not look like that. He had blonde hair. He looked like a young kid with a bad comb over. He just, in these thick, heavy glasses, he was not developed at that point.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about how the look of a character can make all the difference. I mean, I bet once you came up with something that you really felt good about and maybe also could, in a sense, easily draw or it felt natural, I should think that would really aid the creative process a lot.
It's fun to go back and look at the first strips that I did 9 years ago and look at them now and see the change. It's a big, big difference.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you about technology, the fact that, of course, you entered this whole business at a time when, of course, as we all know, sad to be the case, newspapers are in real retreat from where they once were in our cultural landscape. So on the one hand, in terms of it's a world with fewer and fewer newspapers, and so that particular bit of artistic real estate has shrunk considerably, I should think. There just aren't as many newspapers out there, and those that are have to watch their budgets carefully. So you came aboard at the worst possible time in some respects.
I really did. Yeah.
And on the other hand, this other world has sprung up in which one can enjoy comic strips in this entirely different medium and in a sense a limitless universe. Limitless shelf space, in a sense, for comic strips. And now I can go on a website and I can look at every one of the 3,000-plus Brilliant Mind comic strips as effortlessly as that. I mean, how strange that the one world is receding and the other is sort of exploding. So in that respect, you came along at the best possible time.
Well, how do you monetize that, though? See, 95% of my income on the comic comes from newspapers.
Mm.
Just a very, very small sliver from the internet. Because, you know, while King Features offers their Comics Kingdom website, it's sort of a collection of all of the comics that King carries, or most of them, you know, that's ad-driven. That's really, you know, it's number of clicks and ads. And that's very, very little money. So King has been working on this for years, trying to figure out how to extract income from the website and from the comics. And it's not easy to do. You know, I'm sure a comic like Zits draws a fair amount of income from its website, but a lot of the others don't. So that's the one drawback. Yeah, you can hit more eyeballs, absolutely, but you know, the income is less. So.
Right. So in terms of paying the mortgage, that is that's no small matter. You mentioned that, or I mentioned, I guess, that you are recently back from what has to be an incredible event year after year, the annual Reuben Awards, sort of the Oscars of cartoonists. An event sponsored by the National Cartoonists Society. First of all, I have a feeling just about everybody who's anybody belongs to the National Cartoonists Society.
Yeah, pretty much everybody. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. it's just a big party weekend for 5 days. And, you know, I shouldn't say that. But we pick a new city every year. This year it was Washington, D.C. And we spend 5 days just catching up, and it's this really close-knit group of cartoonists that just love to get together, and it is the big Reuben Awards weekend. By the way, the Reuben Awards, Rube Goldberg is where that name came from. It was named after him. In fact, the statue is this. To win the big Reuben, it's like winning the Lifetime Achievement Oscar sort of thing. It's this giant statue about 3 feet tall. It weighs about as much as a small transmission, and it's bronze. But anyway, so we descend in the hotel. The hotels always love us because we're like, you know, they're used to, you know, the toothbrush salesman conventions and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden these cartoonists come in, you know, dressed like they're ready for the beach. we love to draw. They're drawing everywhere. It's just a really, really fun time. Everybody is a member.
Now, is it structured in the sense that when you go to, a toothbrush convention, I mean, then there'll be presentations about toothbrushes and
this and that? I was going to get to that. Yeah, there are presentations. There are usually 5 or 6 cartoonists that are chosen to give a presentation about their work. And so there are those always throughout the day. And then Saturday night comes the big awards dinner. And it is like the Oscars. It opens with a song and dance and a presentation and video and all that. And it's black tie, you know, has a band. If you can imagine 400 of the world's best cartoonists all in one room for this big awards night. If you remember, I was nominated for Best Comic Strip in 2010. So that was a big honor for me. And then they have different division awards. There's Best Comic Strip, you know, Best Editorial Cartoonist Award, Best Newspaper. I mean, there are a lot of, when you say cartoonists, we're not just all newspaper comic strip guys. We have movie producers. We have television producers. We have one of my friends who's a member of the society worked on Phineas and Ferb, the animated series for a couple years. So we're a pretty broad-based group. And, of course, we have all the Jim Davis who does Garfield. He's a member, and Gary Trudeau, and Sparky, Charles Schulz was a very active member until his death. In fact, there's one story where I was not a member at the time. He had brought his baseball glove and a baseball, and he had gotten a number of members to go out into the courtyard at the hotel and play catch. You know, that's the kind of stuff you do. So.
Wow. You were saying that this is a very close-knit world, and these are a lot of people you know very, very well. What is the means by which you actually get to know these other cartoonists so well? Because when you think about it, it's actually a very solitary work, and one, if you chose, could probably live in your own universe and have absolutely no contact whatsoever with any of your counterparts and colleagues.
That, you know, that's a very good point. I'm in contact with a lot of them, you know, on a semi-regular basis. But that's why we always have such a good time. This is the one time a year, and now with Kenosha, you know, Kenosha's getting bigger and bigger, the Kenosha Cartoon Fest.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opportunity for all of us to get together, and you know, we're all in this together. This is not an easy job to do, and we understand what it's like to be in this business and support each other, share ideas, just get together and you know, be around each other for 3 days. It's just so refreshing. I come back from these Reuben weekends feeling completely refreshed and ready to move on to the following year. So that's what they do. They're more than just awards. They're a chance to re-energize and to regroup and share fun times.
Excellent. So you mentioned it, so let's just say a quick word about the next big Kenosha Festival, Cartoonist Festival, which is going to be coming up in September. I think you looked up the specific dates.
Yeah, it's September 17th, 18th, and 19th. And this year's guests are going to be Mark Tatuli. If you ever read Leo in Kenosha News, he does the pantomime strip. Mark is a very multi-talented individual. You'll find out things about him you didn't know. We have Jan Elliott, who does a strip called Stone Soup. And it turns out, I found this out just recently, I thought I held the record for how long it took to get syndicated. Jan has me beat by a year. It took her 16 years.
Mm.
We have Darren Bell, who is an editorial cartoonist. He just won the RFK Award for Journalistic Excellence for his editorial cartoons. We have Bill Morrison, who's a big name. He and Matt Groening of The Simpsons started Bongo Comics. Bill does all of the work for the print of all The Simpsons, and he's also worked on Futurama. So Bill is the new president of our NCS. And by the way, I'm on the NCS board. I'm actually the treasurer of the NCS. So So I work with Bill on a number of things. We have Ed Steckley, who is a local boy. He's from Racine. I think he went to Case High School. He's a well-known illustrator living in New York. Ed will be here. We have Mark Anderson, who does Andertoons. He's made a very successful career of creating online cartoons, and he sells them in a very unique way. And if you're interested in that, you'll want to see Mark, because he'll offer some insight on how you can make a good living on the Internet, unlike what I was saying earlier about us, where we do very little. And that's the lineup for the year. Those six cartoonists, it's going to be great.
I always love the fact that you end up with a group of cartoonists who represent various facets of the field.
Yes.
And that's part of what makes it an even richer experience. And you guys always have a really nice, colorful website in which you kind of lay out all the specifics. And, of course, come September, we look forward to having all of your guests here on the morning show for what's always kind of a freewheeling and exciting program.
Well, if you're ever interested, if you go on the Internet, you can find it at KenoshaCartoonFest.com. We'll list everything going on for this year. And I think she's even put up stuff for 2016, which is going to be an even bigger event, I think. So there's planning in the works for another one.
Very good. Well, this has been a fun conversation, as I knew it would be, and we want to remind everybody that if you happen to subscribe to the Kenosha News, of course, you get to see the brilliant mind of Edison Lee each and every day in that fine newspaper. But otherwise, there's newspapers all across the country. How many are we talking about now?
That's a good question. Over 100. We just picked up recently the Las Vegas Review.
Ah.
And Billings, Montana. So we're getting new markets. It's tough, though. You know, we lost, I think, one paper in the last year, gained, I think, four or five.
Hey, that's
so, those progress.
That's the kind of numbers you want.
You know, those are good numbers. 20 years ago, those were dismal numbers, but those are good numbers today.
Right.
So,
well, it's so great, so gratifying to see this success continuing for you. And we wish you and Anne only the best as you continue on with the brilliant mind of Edison Lee.
Well, thanks, Greg. I appreciate it. Yeah.
So good
it's
to have you
to
here.
Great to be here.
John Hambrock, creator of the brilliant mind of Edison Lee. Tomorrow on the morning show, best-selling author Earl Swift and his newest book, a fascinating book called Autobiography. And in this really intriguing book, he traces the full ownership lineage of one Chevy station wagon from 1957. I mean, he traces it all the way back to the first gentleman who bought that car new back in 1957, all the way to the present day. And it's a remarkable look, not only at recent American history, but also an examination of the really close connection which Americans tend to have with their cars, unlike any other nation on Earth. So that's tomorrow on the morning show, Earl Swift and his book called Autobiography. And on Monday, I hope that you can join me as I preview a really outstanding documentary for the PBS series POV, a documentary called The Overnighters, which tells the story of a small town in North Dakota, which is suddenly overrun by men from all across the country coming to town by the hundreds, maybe the thousands, in search of work because of the fracking operations up there, which have led to the explosion of an oil industry where once there had never been anything of the kind. But some of these small towns have really been overwhelmed and struggled to deal with this dramatic influx of guys from other parts of the country. And this documentary is one wrenching story of a small town trying to deal with that. That will be Monday's morning show. And on Tuesday, Ray Forgiani from Lakeside Market, Harbor Market. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu.